I am calling today from Tucson, which is where my parents live. And my father's 88 years old. My mother's 85. And when I do my sharing later, I'll tell a little, part of my story involves my parents. And we've had kind of a complicated relationship much of my life. And when I was when my father turned 80, at the beginning of that year, I called him and said, "I'm planning my travel calendar for the year. Are you going to have a party on your 80th birthday? Shall I plan a trip to Tucson?" I was living in the Bay Area, which is where I live now. And he said, "No." He said, "This year for my 80th birthday, I'm going to come to California." And really, he never travels to where I live. He said, "I want to spend my 80th birthday with you, and I want us to take the time to heal whatever unfinished business we have before I die." And it was an incredible thing for him to say. And it was January, so I had, his birthday isn't until September. Had the year to think about it, and I was in therapy at the time and worked through some of the fears that I had about telling the truth about, the things that were hard and painful for me in my growing up years. But by the time he came for his birthday, we did have a week where we just spent the week traveling through Muir Woods and went to the beach, and we would just spend a few minutes every day touching on something. And on the last day that he was there, we got to the real heart of what had gone on, and I cried and he cried, and my relationship with my mother and my father from then has gotten progressively better. And now they're aging, and I don't know how much, you never know when somebody's going to die, but things, they're getting closer to that, right? And they need more help now. And I'm here this week completely in service to them. We had a doctor's appointment every single day, and there were many other things to do. And I feel as though I am a devotee with my teacher, and have felt like that from the moment I have arrived last Saturday until now. There wasn't one moment when I'd wanted to be anywhere but here. There wasn't one moment when I wanted to do anything but serve them. And my heart is as full as it has ever been in my life. And I feel like I'm walking kind of a prayer of gratitude for having an opportunity for this core relationship to have been through all that it's been through to have gotten to this place. So that's my story for this week, and thank you for listening.
Thank you,
Wow.
Maya. I felt like I wanted to share something today. It feels almost eerie that Mariana is a guest this week, and given some of the work that she's done, and somewhat specifically what she just shared right now. It's been somewhat of a challenging week because this past Thursday was the second anniversary of my mother's passing. And though there were some, there was, frankly, it was challenging, but there were some bright moments in my week as well. And two of those moments were a friend of mine, sort of in commemoration of that, had sent me a bouquet of flowers. And they happened to be roses, which were my mom's favorite flower. And in her note to me, she had said that, she had sent me a bouquet of different colors, and each of the colors represented a different quality of my mother, whether it was warmth, compassion, humor. And she said that, in taking a look at the, people that are in your life, mothers or your mom's spirit, gift one of those flowers to that you come across, and sort of pay it forward in that sense, whatever your mother has given to you. And so this morning, you know, there's a woman, a very, very strong family friend of ours, and I had given her one of those roses, and we sat and we chatted, and she shared with me a story about my mom, about how when she, you know, this was years ago, this is probably 25 plus years ago, and this woman had, you know, she had moved from India, and she hadn't been to India in almost 7 years to see any of her family. She had no other family here. And there was a point in time in which our family, her family, and another family, a third family, we all lived in one house together. And it seemed like everyone sort of always gang upped on her. And, you know, she always had a hard time, but she kept very quiet and somewhat of an obedient manner. And my mom would see that, but my mom would never say anything to her, but she would always come in and step up and say something to someone else. And she would do it in a way that wouldn't offend anyone. She'd do it in a very sort of laughing way, but just very direct. And she was like, you know, and this lady shared with me this morning, she was like, you know, I never felt like I had anyone here. And your mother was the first person that I felt was there on my side, always stepping in. And we never talked about it, but it was just this shared moment. And in reflecting on, you know, when you think about people that were in your life, and this is a woman too, that, you know, lost her father when she was 4, lost 3 of her 5 brothers, in somewhat succession. She said, when you look back, you know, on those people, the things you remember is not just the memories, but it's the values and how they lived their life and how they impacted others. And so when you look at your life now, you know, think about the values that you want to carry and you want to gift on to others. And so, It was a very touching moment, and so I'm very much looking forward to hearing what Mariana has to say today, not just with Bread for the Journey, but in terms of working with people and helping them with their grief, and hearing her say, talk about the way that she's serving her parents just resonates so deeply with me. So thank you, Mariana.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to turn it over to Rahul, and he is going to lead sort of the next part of this call.
Thanks, Amit. So for those who are listening, just a quick introduction of Mariana. She's the author of a book titled Being There for Someone in Grief, and she's also executive director of Bread for the Journey, which is an organization that strengthens communities through microgrants in support of people's intrinsic generosity. So, Mariana, thank you so much for being here today to share with all of us.
You're welcome.
I actually wanted to start by talking about your book because it gets to the heart of such a universal subject. I mean, as we have just heard from people who've shared on the call, everyone has or will experience the loss of someone close to them. And to call the experience challenging is often an understatement. And you're someone who's spent a great deal of time kind of working with people who have been struggling with this kind of loss. So I wanted to hear more about the sort of circumstances that led you down the path of getting involved with this kind of work and also with writing the book that helps people deal with that subject.
I'd be happy to share with you, and thank you so much. And I want to thank everybody who also shared, whether you spoke aloud or not, your personal stories as we opened this. I'm completely touched by so many things that were said and how the kind of trust has developed among this group to be sort of open, honest, vulnerable, telling the truth. And heart-centered, because I think it just contributes in such a huge way to the kind of world we live in, and very specifically contributes to the depth to which we go in the time that we're together in just this conversation. So thank you all so much for your sharing. My story really began as a young child. My family and I moved from a neighborhood that was that I grew up in, that I was born into, that was one of those old ethnic neighborhoods where you just sort of knew everybody that lived in every one of the houses, and there were two or three generations of people living together, and there was always the smell of food, wafting out to the street, and people left their doors unlocked. And we lived, even in my family, we lived with my grandparents. It was a two-family home with my grandparents, who were Italian immigrants, and my uncle, my father's only brother, who was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis when he was 16 and lived to be 45, and was paralyzed by the time he was in his early 20s. So we had someone that we were taking care of, and was downstairs with my grandmother and grandfather, and we lived upstairs. There were four kids in my family, and two languages being spoken, and it was just this really, it was, the whole neighborhood was kind of like that. And in the summer between my second and third grade, my family moved to what was sort of like a sterile neighborhood where, I know people had lawn of the month signs on their front lawn and houses instead of these big, porches where you could hang out for hours with 10 people. Houses had these little cement stoops, and you just didn't get, everybody went into their backyards now with patios, and you didn't get to know neighbors. And I just really hated this new neighborhood, and it took me forever to find even one friend I really liked. But a few days before school began, my third year of school, third grade, one young girl who lived right in my neighborhood, who had been away for the summer hanging out with her cousins, returned home, and she just drove her bike up my driveway, and it was just, it didn't even take 5 minutes. We were just like, we were twin sisters of separate mothers. We just connected in a way that was, if you believe in past lives, for me, I really believed that we'd been together many times. We were just immediate friends, and that relationship lasted in that manner, that kind of closeness, for 3 years. And in there's kind of a longer story to this that is that's spelled out in the book. But in December of sixth grade, the year that we were in sixth grade, she was kidnapped, and just one day she was there, and the next day she was gone. And we went 3 months. Until 2 months, actually, on February 14th, an anniversary date that's coming right up, and Valentine's Day. For those of you who might not realize that, although I think you probably all do, we discovered that she had been murdered, that her body was, she'd been kidnapped by somebody, her body was dismembered and burned in a backyard incinerator. And the horror of that death, this wasn't just a death, it was a really traumatic death. So I guess you can imagine it made an impact on my life for the rest of my life. And this was 1965 when it occurred, and my grief wasn't really a word. I mean, it wasn't even part of our vocabulary. Psychotherapy was only used by people who, quote unquote, were having a nervous breakdown. There wasn't a self-help movement. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and Stephen Levine, two pioneers of the hospice movement, were just beginning to sort of be known among a very small group of people. And so, really, the way people dealt with it was to keep it inside. That there just wasn't. I went to a Catholic school, and we prayed for her once a day, but her name was never spoken really again. And for me, it was the most bizarre thing in the world, because you can imagine how I felt inside. I was hysterical, really. And but when I looked around, the world would just went on, people still went to work, and the TV still went, and the radio, and people went to school, and classrooms continued. And so the dissonance between those two scenarios the conclusion I drew from that was that there was something wrong with me. It's what kids do, you know, we're egotistical. And we, over a lifetime, grow out of that. But I felt as though what I had to do was to hide this hysterical part of me and pretend like I was like everybody else. And you all know what happens when we do things like that. We grow in distorted ways. And that is what happened. And it wasn't until I was 25 years old, and I made some very bad choices, you know, in my teen years and then leading into my young adult life. All of those stories are spelled out in the book as well. And I won't go into details with them, but I did wake up one day and say, my life is unmanageable and I need some help, and I entered therapy. And when I emerged from that therapy 4 years later, my therapist said to me, now what do you want to do? And what immediately came out of my mouth was that I wanted to create a center for children to grieve as close to the time of the death as possible. That by that point in my life, I knew that grief was an expression of how much we really loved and the connections we have, even if those connections might be difficult, we have with the person who died or that we've lost. There are griefs that happen that are not related to death. It could be divorces and losses in other kinds of ways. But grief is a natural reaction to the very real human connection we have with another human being, and that what was wrong was the hiding of it later. The distortions of my life grew out of that one big decision to hide. And I wanted children. I wanted a place in the community I was living. I was living in Tucson then at the time. My parents had moved here. My sister lives here. My brother had moved here. So my family was moving from the Midwest to Arizona. So I was in Arizona, and I wanted to create a center for children and their families to grieve as close to the time of the death as possible. I wanted a place where the adults in these children's lives could also grieve, and a place where they could learn some very basic and simple skills so that they could help guide their children through this maze of grief. And so I found a center in Portland, Oregon called the Dougie Center, which is still there. And at the time they were the first organization in the country to develop a support program system for how to be with kids in grief. And I called them on the phone, and I asked them if I could come and study with them, and they invited me in, and I spent the summer there, and I learned everything I could about how to create and maintain a center such as this. And I came back to Tucson and created it. And today it's one of the largest social service agencies for children in southern Arizona. It's expanded far beyond the organization that I created, but they're still in the building that we began in, a 3,000-square-foot historic home here in Tucson on an acre of land. And it's a beautiful place today. It's a stable, you know, it's a solid organization. Everybody knows of it in Tucson, where children who are grieving can come and be. There are 350 centers now around the country like this. And the organization has grown. And out of that, many years later, I came to see that grief for me, and I think this is true for many people, opened into a kind of generosity, that out of my hurt and sorrow came a desire to want to serve, to want to help. And so for many years, the way I did that was through the organization that I founded. And when I finally found myself at a place where I needed to step away from the direct day-to-day work of grief, that so much of my life had been focused and centered around grief, I needed something different. That the place where God put me, because I didn't know where I was going, but I ended up in California, and I became the founding executive director of Bread for the Journey, which is all about, I mean, our vision statement is to nurture the seed of generosity in every human heart. And there are many, many ways to do that. And one of the ways that we do it is to, you know, to give 501c3 status to small chapters in 20 cities around the country. And they raise a little bit of money from friends and family and colleagues, and they give it away with no strings attached. And so I've come to see over these years, as the vision statement of nurturing the seed of generosity in every human heart, I've been given opportunity after opportunity to look at my own generosity, to look at, to really actively nurture and grow it as part of an integrity with the mission statement for the organization that employs me. And I've come to now see how, as somebody said in the opening in their personal sharing, that from grief and depths of horror come amazing and wonderful things. I think it was Michelle from Santa Fe who said that, and she was talking about doing her sharing. And and it's really the core thing that I have learned, that we don't have to, you know, it's natural for us to shy away from things that hurt, to step away from pain. And some of you may have read Pema Chodron's work. Her work is really centered around this one concept. She has so many books on so many different subjects. But if you really look at the core of what Pema Chodron shares, she's always saying, yes, it's natural for us to want to sort of shy away and step away and avoid painful situations. But if we can develop the courage to step into them, to kind of lean into them, we develop, I think, a fuller, rather than a bifurcated experience of life, a more whole experience of life. And when we can do that, there's a kind of compassion and a resonance with others who are in painful situations that allows them to trust us, that allows us to be with them in their painful moments in a way that is welcomed, in a way that is trusted, in a way that doesn't invade their space, but that simply creates a container for them to feel a moment of respite or compassion or care, freedom to maybe perhaps even go to the bottom of their sorrow and have some expression of it. What I share often in the book is that I believe we have everything within us that we need to heal, to really move through, completely move through a painful situation that we've been given. The one thing we don't have within us is a companion. That needs to be somebody outside of us. And so I wrote this book because I think it's natural for people to perhaps shy away from difficult situations. And so when we don't get experience, we don't know how to be when we are suddenly with someone who's grieving. We have no practice. And so this book is a very small book written for everyday people that outlines a few simple things that we can do that will make somebody else's grief journey a little lighter. So I'm going to share a simple couple of things from the book to help illustrate and talk about these simple things that we can learn that that aren't always easy, but are simple.
Sure.
I built. Do you have a question?
No. I go ahead and please do. I think we're all on the edge of our seats.
Great. Thanks. I built the book around an acronym called SALT, as in the salt of tears. And so I wanted to have, when we find ourselves in the company of someone in grief, we often, at least me, even after all these years of experience, what happens for me is that my heart starts beating a little bit faster. I'm a little nervous. I notice my mouth is dry. And typically what I want to do is talk. It's anxiety, really. It's anxiety. We all deal with it in different ways, but it's anxiety. And so I thought one of the things that I could do in writing the book is to create an acronym that would be simple. And people, if they're feeling all of those feelings in a moment of being with someone in grief, they might just remember it if I created an acronym. So the acronym is SALT, as in the salt of tears. And S is stands for seeing them, to see them. So if you can really simply see someone who, as they are in grief, without that acting on the urge to do something right away, you kind of have taken the first step. And I will have to say that by the time I learned this, I had been meditating already for many years. And one thing that happened for me is that my breath, I really learned to meditate by counting breath. And so breath for me is now the primary thing that kind of kicks in when I'm present enough to realize that I'm with somebody who has just perhaps tiptoed into a story about grief, or they're testing whether or not I'm available to them. If I'm awake enough to notice that one thing, then the very next thing that I do is slow down my breath and begin being conscious of my in-breath and my out-breath. And with that, my heart rate slows down a bit. And with that, I stop. I stop and I see. I have the tools with me 24/7 for this to occur. And I begin to then do what the next step is, which is the A in SALT, which is allow them to be just as they are. So the S and the A go hand in hand, to simply see someone as they are and then allow them to be as they are is the first step in behaving, I guess, in a way that engenders a trust between the two of you that then allows them to go a step further. Even in an unspoken way, you begin to develop, if you can imagine, a circle traveling through you, through your heart, across to them, through their heart. And there have been times when I've actually visualized that when I've been with somebody. You may get to a place where that person begins talking about their story. But that doesn't always have to occur for this connection that I imagine that goes from my heart to theirs to be vibrant and active and alive. But so I begin by seeing them. I continue that by allowing them to be just as they are. And then if there's a willingness on their part to begin to share something with you about what they're going through, then the L in SALT is what comes next. We really listen. And it's really as simple as closing your mouth. It's not always easy. What happens for me is that in my mind, the messages that I typically get are that I think this person wants me to say just the right thing to make it better for them or to heal them or to make their pain go away. But really what's going on, what really the truth is that they are completely immersed in their story. It is alive for them. It's vibrant. It's active. Whatever it is that's generated this grief is the biggest thing going on in their mind. And if I can convey my compassion through my eyes, or maybe even a nod or a mm-hmm, without any words, especially if I really have conveyed that I see them and I'm allowing them to be just as they are, and then move into listening, they feel, they may not even be able to articulate this, but they feel the safety of what I call a container. And I actually do think of it like a big, huge, beautiful, woven, pliable basket, that I become this container, this safe container for them to go anywhere they need to go and to say anything they need to say, even if it's something horrible. And that I have everything I need within me to be that container for them, to be that safe place for them. And I haven't said a word. It's all unspoken. It's very active, but it's all unspoken. And we use our eyes I can't tell you how many times I have cried with clients, friends, lovers, when they're in that place of sharing. It's a way that connects us. And they know that I can feel what is happening for them.
I understand, Mariana, that you continue to hold one-on-one sessions for people dealing with grief and loss, despite your other journey, your other work with Bread for the Journey, and that you do so specifically in a gift economy model. I wanted to just get into a little bit of how you sort of touched on that concept and then made the choice to serve people in such an intimate way in that model.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to really thank Nipun for that. I didn't even know what gift economy was before I met Nipun at a little coffee shop in Berkeley. And with people here, I think this is true. It was definitely true for me, and I've seen it with so many other people. They hear about this model, and their heart, like, oh my God, you know, we're exposed to so many horrible things in the world, and when you hear about this pure and kind and way of being in the world, and that people are living this way, you know, your very next impulse is to want to do it. And so, I began my own journey when I was 11 years old, and it was in my 30s that I learned this skill, and I have been practicing it and writing about it for another 20 more years. I'm 57 now, well, I guess almost 30 years more. And so to give this now as a gift feels like the most right thing to do in the world. And I do it with the relative ease. I don't take it lightly, but it's not hard work. And I've heard so many horrible stories in the world that I can do this. I can do this. I don't carry it afterwards in a way that creates additional sorrow for me in my life. And it's a gift, and I love doing it, and I receive more than I give in the exchange. And so it just seemed like the most natural thing in the world to do.
I know that a lot of people probably have questions for you, so I'm actually going to open things up to more people to ask questions. As I ask sort of one more, just about what you specifically shared about how natural this felt. I know that a lot of people in the service-based community feel that impulse to sort of freely and deeply give of their gifts. And it's, you know, it's an idea that's a really ancient one. And, you know, we know that it's now has a basis in our neurochemistry, but it's still kind of a very countercultural proposition because we've all been sort of programmed to think of ourselves first. And yet you described it as something that was just sort of that you evolved into. And so I wanted to just hear, before we open up to everyone else's questions, just to hear if there were any edges or challenges for you in getting to a place where it seemed, where it became just a natural thing for you to do.
You know, the thing that's hard about this is that I'm not sure I always had an accurate, or even today have an accurate picture of my own way of being in the world. It was only in these last couple of years that I even saw that starting Children for Children was an act of generosity. Even though so obvious that it was, I didn't have a picture of myself as a generous person. In fact, really, my picture of myself was just the opposite. I grew up in a family where I felt like in so many ways I didn't get my emotional needs met, and so my way of responding to that was to actually grab for things. I wanted a lot of stuff in the world, and so my picture of myself was that. And so it's taken me a lifetime to actually see that generosity has been a natural part of my life. And what I am learning now about the culture, I do a radio show called Ordinary People Doing Extraordinary Things. And what I'm learning, and that plus running Bread for the Journey and meeting, I mean, I get to meet some of the kindest, most generous people in the world and work with them all the time. And what I'm beginning to see more and more is how much this generosity is a part of the human experience, and how I think perhaps there is, you know, because we feel like we need more stuff. I mean, we live in a desire world, right? Maybe we don't express that generosity, but when just the right sort of conditions show up, those generous pieces also show up. And that maybe it's because I'm looking through that lens, I see generosity everywhere. And I'm daily grateful to the ways in which I am inspired to see it. Like, for example, Daily Good, you know, like there's so many times when I go through my emails and I get all kinds of stuff and I delete. I never delete one of those. You know, it's nourishment and food to help nurture the seed of generosity in me. So I hope that answered your question. I'm not sure it did. But.
Yeah, it did. And I actually think that a lot of people have questions as well. So if you have a question, go ahead and press star. star 6 to get in that queue. And all of this is so deep, I could keep going with any line of any number of the things that you've thrown out. But I think other people want to ask questions as well.
Rahul, while we're waiting for people to jump on the queue at star six, I did have two quick questions for Mariana, if you don't mind. First was, thank you very much for sharing what you did. It's just incredible. So you had started to define salt, seeing, allowing, listening. And so what was chi? Anyway, I don't think we had a chance to get to that.
Thank you. We didn't, and I was going to bring it up. Chi is trust, the process. That there is, if I can see someone just as they are, stop and see them just as they are, if I can then allow them to be just as they are, no matter what's showing up in my eyes and in my circle, and I can listen well, that we've begun a journey, and that journey may have all kinds of circuitous things that happen. But if I can keep coming back to this, seeing them, allowing them to be as they are, and listening well, listening generously, that there is a process that occurs that will bring them to a full healing. It may not ever go away, but it'll heal. Then I trust. Then I can trust the process. That is, I will add this. If there's anybody that really wants to learn this well, then I would recommend volunteering somewhere for even a year where you're working with families in grief. And there are, like I said now, there are 350 centers around the nation that are modeled after the Dougie Center. Although the Dougie Center didn't teach salt, that was something that came out of my imagination, essentially what I'm talking about, they do teach. And you can go onto the Dougie Center's website and you can plug in a zip code under find a location and you'll find something near you. Find them, go through their training, and volunteer for a year. I promise you, your life will never be the same. You will learn this so well, and it will impact every relationship you have in your life.
Thank you. The second question I had, and again, I'll make this brief as well, is that, you know, I feel that with the salt process, it makes, you know, it almost seems common sense now that you explain it in that way, you know, just being that container for someone. But how does it work with children? Because it would seem that, you know, with them there, it would require you to do maybe a little bit more of an encouragement, but perhaps I'm incorrect in that assumption. And so how does that work with smaller children?
Kids, in some ways, kids are easier because they're more naturally in touch with whatever it is that they're doing. But kids, you need the key thing to remember with kids is that they express themselves through play. That really play is how they play out what is going on inside. And so with kids, what you want to do is to just be with them in the ways that they most want to be and let them kind of guide the way. It changes. You know, the answer to that question changes depending upon the ages of the kids that you're working with. But at children to children, the way the evening would work, let's say, I'm just going to give you a few examples to answer this question. The families would arrive. We'd have a quick stand up in a circle, hold hands, introduction of the evening. And then the kids would separate into a whole separate part of the house from the adults. And the rooms that we had for the kids, the first one began with a room that was, you know, had a circle of bright colored pillows on the floor filled in with stuffed animals that were puppets. And we'd sit in circle with the kids for 10, 15, 20 minutes, and we'd just say aloud, we're all here because we've had somebody in our life die. And there was one adult for every two kids, and we created an environment where we'd go around the circle and each person had the freedom, or they could pass, say something about the person who died in their life. Once we got through that circle, then the rest of it was activities. We had one room where there was a bank of phones and a kitchen, and kids could use it to call somebody who had died and have a conversation, and they did it all the time. We had a dress-up room. We had outdoor play. We had art activities. We had a playground. So sometimes when we'd have a kid that was in the midst of it, you know, I just hang out with them on the swing set and be with them in the way that they want to be. And if you are communicating in an unspoken way that you are a safe person for them to be completely who they are, they will get it, and they will begin a process with you that will lead to a kind of healing. And it's not always visible, and there are lots of books written about kids and how to be with them in this way. So I hope that's helpful. That's a beginning.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you. Our next caller.
Ariana, this is Nipun. Thank you for these wonderful stories and your natural way of articulating things. I just wanted to see if you could link up the sort of part of your journey that dealt a lot with grief and this new part of your journey that seems different on the surface, but it feels like one big continuum. So if you could talk a little bit about the connection, the way you see it, between suffering and grief and generosity and kindness, and perhaps even share some of the stories of small acts of generosity and how you've been so anchored in small. I wonder if the small has something to do with the connection to the grief, because if you can't be really ambitious about generosity, I mean, people do get ambitious about generosity, but if you really connect it to suffering, it feels like one of the side consequences of that is that you're going to be really connected to the small. Those are kind of disparate thoughts, but I wonder if that elicits a response, and if you could articulate a bit more around that connection.
Thanks, Nipun. I think I can. I think, and I'd like to begin with a quote from the person who founded Bread for the Journey. His name is Wayne Muller, and he's written several books. This is from a book that he wrote called How Then Shall We Live? And it goes like this. Thus our sorrow becomes our gift. From within our tender hurt, there can spring kindness, generosity, and love for others. In our grief and confusion, we may mistakenly believe we have no offering to bring the family of the earth. But mere suffering cannot extinguish the priceless gift of our true nature. As soon as we begin to heal, the instant we experience some degree of inner clarity or spaciousness, in the very next breath, generosity naturally arises. As we feel the measure of our own strength, we simultaneously experience a natural impulse to share it. This is not fate. This is simple spiritual physics. As we are fed, so do we wish to feed others. Mm. Wayne's written a lot of books. This one is maybe 10 years old, but it still remains my favorite book. It's called How Then Shall We Live? So for me, now having the long view, I'm 57 and I'm looking back over the span of my life, it feels to me that grief and generosity are intrinsically linked, and certainly they have been for me, that in my grief there opened a passageway that quite naturally led to generosity. But I think there is you know, something that Parker Palmer talks about in his most recent book, Healing the Heart of Democracy. We have a choice when we go through a painful experience. We have a choice to have our heart break apart or our heart break open. And what I know when I have not had my heart break open into a more vulnerable place is that it's painful. It is painful. It's isolating. It's dark. It's tight. There's shame. And then the minute I begin to let that painful thing, like, open the door a little bit to some fresh light, some fresh air, if I begin to share out loud with even one person the story of my whatever it is, it's just the opposite of what depression wants. You know, what it wants is isolation. And if I can move outside, that's what the beauty of this collective that you've created here with Service Space is and can be. The minute I begin to come out of that dark place and share my story, then my heart begins to break open instead of break apart. And there's a depth of compassion that arises. It was Arthur who told the story of cooking and giving this food to the homeless person and having that person tell the story of how they prayed all day long for a meal and how that became the loop, you know, the loop of generosity that fed both of them and brought Arthur to a place of saying, always share food. It is how it works. And it's like, and I, you know, people say to me that I'm kind of, I don't know, that I have this thing of always seeing the good in people. And it is the lens that that came to, maybe it was with me my whole life. I've always been sort of an outgoing person, but it certainly has been nurtured by the fact that I have been to some of the darkest places inside of me, and that it was human beings, whether they knew it or not, that saved my life, that shared something that brought me out of my darkness and saved my life. And I see this in everyone. And I think we all have that capacity. And so in that way, generosity is the most natural thing in the world to grow out of grief. Have I answered your question, Nathan?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, that's great. Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next caller.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello?
This is Lavanya from Pittsburgh. Mariana, thank you so much. I'm actually in tears listening to what you just said. My question was about, actually, part of it you did answer already, about how one can heal oneself. You did speak about how one can be there for others. Can you shed a little light on how you think one can be there for oneself?
Mm-hmm.
You did speak about it a little bit as you were mm-hmm. sharing, and how resharing is one part of it. If you could say something more, that would be great.
Sure. For me, I think we have to find our thing, the thing that opens us, you know. In my life growing up, words were really, when I sat down to write, I always felt better when I got up. And I recognized that early on. And so my journals became my most treasured, life-saving devices. And today, if you were to come into my office and I opened up my armoire door, you would find 3-ring binders with the year on each one of them, some of them 3-inch wide binders with things that I have written from the time that I was a young girl. And so one of the best ways that I could take care of myself was to write. And pretty soon I learned, once I began giving that to myself, once I began listening to my own heart, I began finding people who I trusted enough to then take the place of my writing. I began sharing out loud what was going on inside of me with other human beings. That really did take me a very long time because what happened for me when Susan was murdered was, I share this in depth in the book, I had an experience of going to visit her parents, and I got to see really close up the kind of sorrow and pain they experienced. You can only imagine what a parent has to go through if they know their child has been killed in the way that Susan was killed in the way that Susan was killed. And so it freaked me out. As a child, I really didn't have the tools to help. And so I remember going back to my house. I remember sitting in a very dark room, and I remember thinking, oh, my God, this is what happens when we love. There's no thermostat when we love with that kind of love. There's no thermostat on how much we love when we have children. And so this is kind of the flip side of love, that we are vulnerable enough that we could be hurt this deeply by that love. And so as a child, and with nobody to help correct this, my response was to stop giving my love, to be afraid to give my love to others. And it's been an entire life's work to get to the place where I could be with my mom and dad this week in the way that I am with them. So I first had to learn how to be there for myself before, and trust myself before I could trust another human being with any of my thoughts. And so we all have to find our way. What is that one thing? And it just takes being awake. It takes being present. It takes being alert to what that one thing is. For someone who's a painter, it might be painting. For someone who's a musician, it might be the act of writing music. For me, it was journaling. But we all have our way, and we have to find our way. There might be several things. It's a process of being awake. And I think meditation also, when we meditate, we nurture the seed, even if we can only sit for 2 minutes, we nurture the seed of self-knowing that then becomes the answer to your question about how we take care of ourselves. Did I answer that question well for you?
Yes, wonderfully. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Again, if there's anyone on the call that has a question, please push *6 and you'll be added to the queue. Perfect. Looks like we have Arthur next.
Hi, this is Arthur. Marion, I want to thank you so very, very much for sharing with us all that you did.
You're welcome.
I play in a band, and we play all over California. This Sunday, one of the fundamental members of our play died. We don't know whether he was killed. We don't know how he died. We just found out how he died. And it is my natural thing to do now is to just pull away, because it has always been a tremendous joy for me to play music and watch people dance and be happy and joyful. It's like that's my contribution. I couldn't see, after hearing of his death, that there was no way I could go and do that again. I tend to be happy when there is so much grief that I'm experiencing out of knowing that he was such a good man, he was such a great man, heart of gold, and to know that he was either killed or died this Sunday is unbearable. But when you say that, you know, grief either breaks our heart open or breaks it apart, it gives me some courage to go back, because I didn't want to go back again at all.
Mm-hmm.
And to know that if I can be open to generosity, that can continue. So thank you so very much. So as I had made a firm decision, I wasn't going back. Thank you, and I thank you for sharing that, and so I can share that with the other people on the band who may be tempted to not go back or not to do it. Thank you that I can share that with them, so that they too can continue to share their music and share their joy around the world and not to pull away. So thank you very much.
You're welcome, Arthur. You're welcome. There's always, you know, there's just a time for everything, isn't there? There's a time to grieve and a time to sing and a time to dance and a time to love and a time to be quiet and a time to be vibrant. And when we can learn through life's experiences to be part of all of it, to be fully a part of all of it, to not shy away from any of it, this is how we become whole human beings. This is how we become whole human beings. Thank you, Arthur. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Arthur. Thank you, all of you. Mariana, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I know we have one more question. I'll let that slide in, and then I'm going to kind of recap the call, and we'll just kind of go from there. So we'll just try to make this question short, please. Go ahead, Michelle.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is Michelle from Santa Fe. I'm not sure it's one of my greatest skills to make things short, but I'll try. Mariana, thank you so much for everything you're doing in the world. On behalf of humanity, I offer my gratitude. Clearly, the impact you have made is huge, both on an individual basis and on a group basis.
Thank you.
That's where I'd like to ask another question. I have lived in many places in the world and work now at the level of exploring what's a transformational global leadership, and in particular, what's a lifestyle that is consistent with a commitment to every human being. And I have found myself, I spent my childhood in Africa, Central Africa, and recent years have now found myself working with people from Rwanda and Liberia and the Congo, and people that are working at the level of huge group traumas and conflicts. And I'm wondering if you have any experience with that, or what you have found in terms of maybe the differences between working with an individual and working with a group, and perhaps with sometimes it seems that the trauma is so big one person possibly can't hold it. And so sometimes there's a sense of a need, I have found, to just bypass the grieving process because there isn't room or time or capacity to hold it. Just wondering what your thoughts.
Yeah. I'll try and be as brief as I can with this answer. And what I would say is the groups that I have worked with where we've done big healing work, we were focused on healing grief. And I find that people are that sometimes there's much more power in that healing process when there are large groups of people, but the time together really has to be dedicated to the time it takes to listen to each person have a moment, you know, to have 3, 4, 5, 6 minutes to have the floor and to teach those who are in the room with that person what it is to be deeply present and to hold space in a way that is, you know, all encompassing and respected and listening, deep listening, the presence that I write about in the book. So it can be done, and it can be done quite beautifully with an intentional group. And I would encourage you to perhaps read this book and to stay in touch with me, and I can go more deeply into how you might facilitate these groups of people to be there with each other, because there's no doubt in my mind that this can be a very big and powerful healing experience for everybody, because everybody gets involved. With just a little bit of training and skill and leadership, you can do some phenomenal things. And I thank you for asking the question. I want to say to everybody that if you need to be in contact with me, you can. The notice has the name of the book, Being There for Someone in Grief, has the link to my website. You can contact me that way, or you can call me at 415-305-5700. I'm happy to respond to anything. I'm happy to be of service.
Thank you. Michelle, I mean, we've just hit upon our sort of 90-minute time limit and want to be mindful of everyone's time and especially yours. Wanted to know if you had time for one more question before we close it out.
I'd be happy to, yes.
Great, thank you. Next caller, I think it's...
Hi, Mariana, this is Trevor calling from Detroit. Mine's going to be very short. It's just to say a very heartfelt thank you to you for offering us a set of tools to apply to those around us who are grieving. I shared with this circle some time back that I had two friends who had been contemplating suicide, and they confided with me on the same day, so I was taken aback. But I was able to be with them and kind of intuitively apply this skill set, but it's unfortunate to know that I now have something a little bit more formal as I progress and offering whatever I can to folks. So, again, just thank you so much for what you offer today.
You're welcome. You're so welcome.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you all for helping, just being present and co-creating this space. And Mariana, a very special thank you to you just for opening up so deeply and sharing some very sort of powerful moments, from the death of Susan, from when you were so young. You can see that those it still reverberates today in many ways, but you have taken something so tragic, so traumatic, and created something so positive and impactful that even all of us who are just listening on the phone today have just so many incredible takeaways, tears of compassion, tears of joy. And so we are very, very grateful for your presence today. And we will send a sort of a follow-up email to everyone with a brief recap of the call, as well as with some links to the book and to some of the work that you do. And that way, and if people want to follow up with you, then they can as well.
Thank you.
And so with that, I was hoping we could all close out with a minute of gratitude in silence. And then I'm going to unmute everyone, and we can just kind of share our thank you as a group and our love with Mariana as well. A moment of gratitude, please.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'm going to just hit the turn off the mute button here. And then on the count of three, if everyone can give Mariana kind of a big group virtual hug and a heartfelt thank you. One, two, and three.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, we have a little kid listening. Mariana, thank you. That was awesome. Really appreciate
yeah.
it.
Yeah, thank you for the opportunity. I love you all. Thank you so much.
You got
Bye.
It. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you, and tune in next week. Same time, same place.